So I'm Ben Robertson. I'm the campus minister with RUF, and these are our lovely faculty panelists. And if you guys could quickly introduce yourselves, tell us your name, where you're from, a little about yourself and your family, and what your favorite Netflix binge is. Yeah.
All right.
Start with Justin.
I am Justin Stevens. I'm a professor in the physics department. I've been here for 4 years now. I have a family, a wife, and two boys. Hobbies include watching them play baseball, which we do a lot. favorite Netflix binge, we just started watching The Good Place pretty regularly. Nice. And guilty pleasure that's not Netflix, is anybody American Ninja Warrior fan? Yeah, a few. Yeah. All right.
And could you quickly tell us what a P case is?
A P case.
Sounds awful.
It sounds like it's bad disease, right? a P case is a presidential early career award for scientists and engineers.
Which Justin recently was awarded. Yeah. Got to go up to Washington, D.C. I know. We'll ask you more specifically about what you do and how you got that in a little bit. But some friends, we were consoling Justin last week because he got to go up to D.C., but he did not get to meet the president, whom he loves and has a portrait of him next to his bed. And he was having a hard time with it. But congrats on the P case. And then, Alex, same questions, except for the P case one.
Okay. My name is Alex Josie. I am in public policy. I see a couple public policy people out there. Now I forget all the questions. I am from New Jersey. And I have three little kids, 18 months, 4 years, and 6 years. So it's quite a zoo in our house most of the time. We've been here now. This is the start of my fourth year teaching, and I love William & Mary. My husband went to William & Mary, so I have tri-pride in my blood. And
Netflix.
Yeah, I was going to say The Good Place, too. I have not just recently started it. I am on like whatever they will let me watch. The most recent. I like all kinds of things on Netflix. I like Madam Secretary and things that are kind of a little bit more political. And I also like the British Baking Challenge or whatever that show is particularly called. Thank you. Thank you. I think that covers it.
Thanks. All right. Hi, I'm Aaron Griffith. I'm a philosophy professor. This is my fifth year at William & Mary. I grew up in Kansas. I've lived in Michigan. I've lived in California. And now Virginia, so kind of all over the place. Let's see, not Netflix, but we just finished watching Game of Thrones, and so I'm still thinking about it and being disappointed in the way that it ended, like everybody else is. But yeah, that's the thing that's been on my mind, and I'm like, my parents are giving us their old, very big TV, and so I'm excited to like watch it again on the big TV. So, nice. Yeah.
So thank you guys for being here, and I meant to mention we have gifts for you, and I told you guys before, but this is like National Signing Day, you know, with the hats up front, but there's only one choice of what team you can play for, but those are for you guys, including the glowy pins. So if you could tell us briefly how you came to Christian faith, all three of you, you know, profess faith, tell us how you came to faith, where you go to church currently, and just a little bit about your stories personally.
Yeah, so I grew up in a Christian household. My dad was a Southern Baptist minister for the first 15 years of my life. We grew up going to church every Sunday, every Wednesday, every Sunday night. At some point, around 10 years old, realized that this was a relationship that I needed to have myself. It was this personal connection, and so then became a believer at that point.
I have a different story, so that works. I did not grow up as a Christian at all. My father was from the former Yugoslavia, which was communistic when he was growing up, so definitely no faith there. And my mom is from Germany, and so also not super religious country. So I had a lovely childhood. I'm the youngest of three. I'm going to try to make this succinct. But I didn't really have any interaction with faith when I was growing up, and thought I had a great childhood, and I did. I went through the typical, so I went to Stanford for my undergraduate education in California, which...
Have you guys heard of that, Stanford?
often confused with Stamford, Connecticut.
Or Samford in Birmingham, Alabama. Yeah.
So maybe this is just my stereotype, but I think of Californians as a little bit less, more hostile towards religion. And we actually, we had a conversation. He said there's a really strong RUF chapter there, which I would have told you nobody was religious on my campus. We just didn't talk about it. I had a lot of kind of negative stereotypes about religion, kind of probably typical things that you've heard of before, but intelligent people aren't Christians. People who are, you know, who are Christians just don't think for themselves. And so I held a lot of those stereotypes. And to skip several steps in the story, basically it took getting to know people who defy those stereotypes to start planting seeds. And I think only in retrospect can I connect those dots. But one of those, you know, several people close to me ended up kind of sharing their faith with me. And they were people that I really respected and people that were very intelligent and kind and kind of defied all these stereotypes. And so I'm a very rational, logical person. And so it took kind of thinking about faith on those terms and recognizing that I, you know, it, I'll never forget the moment I read The Case for Faith by Lee Strobel, and he lays out kind of logical, rational arguments for why faith is, it's less of a leap of faith to believe in God than to not believe in God. And I just remember that moment being like, whoa, that's so true. And so it was, it wasn't like an insta transformation, but little things along the way, like every time I went to church, I met my now husband who was a strong Christian his whole life, and also somebody who I think obviously respect a tremendous amount, and he kind of took me through it, was able to answer my questions. Recognizing that it's okay to have questions was another big jump for me, that not every Christian never wavers. So just little things along the way. So I became a Christian 8 years ago now. No, it's 2019. In 2008, a little bit more than one. 11 years ago now. And it's still a process, but it's been a glorious process. So sorry that was longer.
That was great. No, thank you.
Yeah, I also grew up in a Christian home in Kansas, Evangelical Free Church. You know, on the conservative side, but not fundamentalist. High school and college were challenging. I had a lot of intellectual struggles with doubt. Not so much doubt in God's existence, but just doubt in doctrines and the way that I was taught those doctrines. And so college was a really tumultuous time for me. It was really a time of deconstructing my faith. And I went to a Christian school, and so fortunately, it was the sort of environment where I could have that deconstruction performed and then have the reconstruction also built up. And so I'm really thankful for going to the school that I did and having the professors that I did. That was just I think, key to maintaining my faith through college and past college. And like I said, I don't think I've ever doubted that God exists. And I've always found Jesus just completely compelling as a person. And that's really been the core that's sustained me through doubts and kind of theological changes in my thinking. It's preserved me through disillusionment with the church. But yeah, just finding Christ just a compelling person, not only as an example of how to live and love, but also as a source of life and a source of hope and ultimately renewal of the world.
So just a quick reminder, you can text questions to that number. So guys, if I'm looking at my phone while you're answering some questions, it's not that I'm not interested in you.
Just, you're bored with this.
The questions will come to my phone, and I'll kind of filter through them. But you can ask questions of individual panelists or the whole panel, however you want to do it. Ask your questions, and this is something that we do every single week at RUF. We want you to be able to voice your questions and speak into it. So just a reminder, I've got it right here. Next to my heart is where I keep my phone. Another kind of broad question here. Could you tell us kind of briefly how you got into your field? What was it about physics, public policy, philosophy that kind of drew you in?
Right. So I got started in physics. I was always interested in math and sciences growing up. It was something I was pretty good at. And so it was something pretty natural to continue in. I really thought I was going to be an engineer. I was going to design things, build things. And then I went to college and took a class called Modern Physics. And in Modern Physics, you learn about sort of the history from 1900 or so into the 1950s, 60s, where we kind of developed all of the modern techniques for studying atoms and subatomic physics. And then one of my professors let me know that you could actually make a living doing something like this. And then we started to learn about things like particle accelerators, where you could build a very high-energy machine and smash particles together and learn something new about fundamental ingredients in the universe. And I thought, yeah, building big toys and smashing particles together sounds like fun. And so I went to graduate school and worked on an experiment doing this. And then continued on after that as a postdoc and then as a researcher. And there's a lab actually quite close to here called Jefferson Lab. It's down in Newport News, Virginia, where we have one of these particle accelerators. And so many of the folks in the physics department and elsewhere around campus are interested in this. And that's kind of what brought me into the field, and it's still lots of fun today.
And this, anybody can answer this, but I wanted to ask quickly, what is a gluon?
Anybody else want to take that one? So physicists are very clever in our naming system. A gluon is something that holds other particles together. So it's the glue that holds particles together. So protons are made of quarks, are the ingredients inside of protons, and gluons are the springy things that hold the quarks together inside the proton. It just so happens that a lot of my research is what are gluons and how do they affect the particles we know about in nature? Yeah. Thanks, Ben, for the softball.
Yeah. same question. What's a gluon? What drew you into public policy?
I am type A. I bet nobody here is also type A here at William & Mary. I like to organize things. If I weren't in academia or working in public policy, I might be at like the Container Store. That's kind of just my personality. And so undergrad, I did economics. And so I like that kind of mathy side of things. But public policy to me, this gets into another question that I know is coming. So I'm going to save some of it. But I'm attracted to kind of making things work better. And in public policy, a lot of what we do is look at what the government machine has kind of produced, the laws that they've produced, and try to figure out how to implement them efficiently, effectively, equitably. That attracts me, this ability to not only the public service component, which I'll talk about later, but taking something and making it more efficient. I'm also German, so this none of this should surprise you at this point now.
In high school, I hung out with friends who are just nerds, and we talked philosophy almost every lunch period. And I didn't know that that's what we were doing. I just thought we were doing like intellectual stuff. And so I didn't know that there was a field of philosophy where you could actually think clearly about these things. And so I just remember like being driven, even like as a freshman in high school, like by some of these questions. They just bothered me, and I was kind of angsty, and I was kind of introspective and like prone to existential crises in my life. And so freshman year of college, I read Friedrich Nietzsche's Antichrist, and I was just like, oh my God, I have to figure out if this is true or not. I have to like understand this. And I think, bizarrely, I started out as an engineering major too. I had no idea. I had no understanding of myself at that time. So
me too, actually.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So engineering and then architecture, then sociology, then religion, then philosophy was my declared major path. You can imagine what sort of like frustration I was to advisors.
And your parents.
And my parents, right. But they were great about it in the end. They were great about it. So philosophical questions were just so exciting to me. They were the sort of things like, I want to have knowledge about this. I want to understand how to think like this. I want to understand how to do what my professors do, because I was just so impressed with them. Like, how can you know all this stuff? How can you like have all these logical moves and argumentations, you know, memorized? You know, that was really exciting to me.
So kind of big picture question. How does your Christian faith sort of inform or shape the way you think about your academic discipline?
Well, so in physics, we think about trying to describe the natural world, things we observe, the universe, in terms of a set of rules. So can we come up with the laws that describe how nature behaves so we can measure them, confirm them, refine them, improve them? And so one of the cool things about thinking about that through a faith perspective is that if we believe in a creator God, we know the guy who wrote the master rule book, the master physics textbook that exists, and that goes beyond anything I could measure in the lab, anything I could think about producing at a particle accelerator. Thinking about it in that light, it makes me feel kind of small because I'm looking at some very minuscule picture of this large universe that's been created. But it also gives me sort of a chance to take a sneak peek at what part of that rule book looks like. And so as I think about faith and how it impacts my field of study, is I get some sort of small view of what this big picture looks like at a really fine detailed level.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
So for me, I mean, the fundamental of who Jesus was about is somebody who loved the least of these and loved everybody. And policy for me is a way to care about those people, care about everyone, to craft ways to directly impact their lives for the better. You know, keeping that guiding framework in my head is always kind of it's everybody makes decisions in different ways. And one of those big ways is your kind of moral compass or your value system. And that is a big part of how I look at how is this policy going to affect people? Who is it going to affect? All of those decisions. And, you know, that's how we care for those people in our country, is to create ways and policies to make their lives easier and better.
In my introduction to philosophy classes, I attempt to define philosophy, which is dangerous, but I define it as the endeavor to use your mind well for the purpose of living well. And in the Bible, we're called to love God with our minds. And so I think of philosophy as a way of doing that, as a way of using our minds well for the purpose of glorifying God, and that contributes to living well, I think. So I think philosophy and my faith are intertwined at a very deep level. St. Anselm has this idea of faith seeking understanding, that faith, you know, can come first, but then there can be an exploration of that faith. Again, a faith seeking understanding that has also driven me. I think my faith has also guided some of the projects that I have began to engage in, especially related to gender and race, and a lot of the same sorts of ideas of, you know, seeking justice for the least of these has been a motivating factor in the kinds of projects that I choose.
So the second question is like the first, like unto. How does your discipline shed light back on your Christian faith? What insight might you have that sort of maybe the rest of other Christians are kind of missing out on, but that you kind of have a clue into because of the depth of study you've gone into?
Well, so as we think about physics as this kind of rule book for the universe, there are some sort of interesting features that you find out along the way as you dive deeper into physics. And one of them is that there are lots of things that have to be just right for the universe and life to exist as we know it. So in physics, we think about these as some fundamental constant. So there's a number somewhere that describes how the proton and electron masses are related, or how they're how they interact inside of an atom. And if the ratio of those masses are different, or if the strength of the force between them is different, then atoms wouldn't form and stay in the way that they are. Similarly, in sort of our picture for how the universe evolved in sort of our standard picture of physics, we expect that equal parts matter and antimatter should have been produced in the early universe. And if that were the case, there would not be a matter universe like you and us around. And so we need some fundamental constant of nature that provides that differentiation between matter and antimatter. So we have these ingredients, and there are things that we don't know where they come from, but they are certainly ingredients in the universe that we live in. And while I don't think you'd find a lot of scientists would say that the sort of what we call the fine-tuned nature of these constants, they would tell you that this is sort of direct evidence or proof that God exists, but it certainly is true that there are a unique set of circumstances that we're currently living in. And so this gives some perspective as I think about how science impacts my life of how a creator God is related to this world we live in.
This is a hard question. When I was reflecting on this, I think about the fact that policy, kind of what policy is about, is taking situations that seem, problems that seem intractable, really complex problems, and kind of chipping away at them through well-defined, well-analyzed policy proposals, solutions. And I'll give you, so I forgot to mention in my introduction, I go to the chapel, which is a huge church here. I'm used to very small churches, and I think it's easy when we first walked into the chapel to think, I can't change anything here. It's just like kind of a machine of a church. You know, there's no point in trying to change anything. But the policy part of me says that this is a big, I don't want to call it a problem, it's a great church. It's a big machine. It's kind of a bureaucracy, if you will, if you want to compare it to government. And the way that I'm trained is to start chipping away at it and to do, everybody can make those small changes. And so my husband and I have jumped in, and in areas where we see things that we want to improve, we do that. We, you know, research the problem, quote unquote, in church terms, and we've offered solutions, and it's pretty amazing to see how well received that is. That even in, you know, when you zoom back out to the policy perspective, there are some huge big problems, and sometimes it's easy to just be paralyzed and think that we can't do anything about them. And knowing that, you know, thinking about faith and how many things just seemed impossible that God made happen makes me both realize in policy and in places like my own life that I can make those changes. I can do those things through kind of reasoned analysis and those types of things.
So I have a follow-up question before we move on to Aaron, because we've gotten a few great questions in here with a similar theme for you, sort of like, if I can sort of paraphrase these, what role do you see Christians having in sort of influencing public policy? And to what extent, you know, do we take like the Israelite code from Leviticus and, you know, in the Old Testament and apply that to modern society? Or what does it look like for a Christian as a member of the American system? Where do you see that working out? I mean, is it the Christian right and we control people's lives and enforce particular codes that maybe the rest of the country doesn't share on the whole, or how does that all work? It's easy, it's a softball kind of question.
That is a softball question. Gosh, that is a hard question. So I have my own kind of beliefs on a lot of political issues.
What are those?
So let's start, just toss them at me. I think we tend to think, and this may be wading in deeper than I can care to tonight, but I think we tend to paint with broad brushstrokes, where if you're a Christian, you are on this side of maybe the political spectrum or on this side of an issue. And my personal belief is that we can exist on a spectrum of all of those beliefs, even as Christians. There are so many issues that I like to be a big picture Christian, where I like to have my guiding light being that Christ died for our sins. He, you know, took care of the least of these, that we should love one another. And there are a lot of things that we can argue about around those things. And, you know, there have been wars around these things and denominations have split over some of these issues. But I think that each of us as Christians, if you have that guiding light, can look at some of these bigger policy issues and do some good reasoned analysis that leads you to different conclusions on matters. So I don't tend to think that all Christians should definitely believe X on this particular topic. I think there is room for different views on that that can all be defended with a Christian viewpoint. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's as far as I'll go.
That's great. And my trick I use, because when we do text a question, I'm just like, let's get coffee. That's my kind of go-to. Because these are complex, complicated issues that take, you know, hours to dissect. So, yeah, thank you. That was really helpful. So, what was our original question? How does your understanding of philosophy kind of shed light back on the faith that would be helpful for normal uses to know?
Yeah, I can think of three ways that philosophy contributes to matters of faith. One is just in the articulation, interpretation of our traditions, our faith traditions. So that can be like clarifying what our doctrines are, what our confessions say and what they do not say. So that's one role. Another role is just defense of the faith. I think that does have a place to play. There are certainly ideas that are counter to Christian ideas, and I think philosophy can play a role in, you know, the defense of the faith and providing arguments for God or why it's rational to believe. I think it has a role to play there. And then third, I think it also plays a role in criticism, that philosophy can help kind of promote internal critique that Christians often, I think, fall into a very rigid us versus them mentality and thinking that the world out there is the corrupt one and that we're pure. And that we're not at fault in this.
Just like Jesus said about religious people.
Right. And so turning that gaze backwards, that kind of critical stance backwards towards ourselves, I think, again, this is not the main domain of philosophy, but I think that philosophy has a role to play in, you know, counteracting anti-intellectualism, counteracting heresy, if you want to call it that, or, you know, just critiquing the church when it's strayed from its mission to be a light to the world.
That's great. So there were about six or seven questions generally asking kind of what is it like for you sort of more personally as a Christian member of the faculty, and do you talk about your faith openly with your colleagues? Have you experienced, you know, anywhere from awkwardness when someone discovers that you're a Christian, or hostility on an extreme end, or, you know, there's quite a few questions about that. So if you guys could speak to sort of the in-the-shoes experience of being a Christian faculty member at William & Mary.
Yeah, so I have not personally had any particularly negative encounters with colleagues or students who had taken offense or had some kind of took issue with this. And to be honest, I think we find even more than we realize other people of faith nearby. We were talking about this even before, that these events for us are ways for us to find out who are the other faculty of faith on campus and learn more about this. And I think more often than it's sort of argumentative, it's more inquisitive. So you say you believe this. You're also a scientist who believes in evidence. How do you put these two together? And that's a good chance to go get coffee, because it takes hours to unpack this. But I think there's lots of chance for conversations that can come from this rather than sort of negative connotations, in my opinion.
So as the newest Christian at the table, I think, and knowing how, what did we establish, 11 years ago, I, maybe a little bit longer than that, thought about Christians or religious people in general. I think most of my experience is like in my head, what I imagine other people are thinking. My lived experience I've had no negative experiences. I'm sure some of you can relate to this. I feel like it's breaking the ice a little bit, where it's like, when I went to church the other weekend, oh, you go to church too, great. It's like, we're past that. I feel like there are a lot more Christian people here than I even realize. And it's a shame that we don't bring it more into what we do. I think there is a bit of a, I still have a bit of a taboo. I don't want to be necessarily talking about faith all the time in my classroom. And so I don't, but ways of kind of slipping it in, or certainly when students come to my office hours and get to know me, that's oftentimes where it has come up. But I've had no negative experiences. It's all the voice in my head that creates potential awkwardness.
Yeah. I think often it's more awkward for the believer, like being sort of trepidatious about talking about it, whereas other people's like, well, let's talk about politics, let's talk about whatever, you know, like, yeah.
Same experience. I've had very few negative experiences in academia, and that's in state schools across the country. I find that most people have, it's kind of a live and let live attitude, I find, among most academics. Like, privately, of course, they might sneer at what you believe, but I've never had anybody confront me or anything like that. It's always, you know, the offhanded comment, but, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, yeah, maybe that's an opportunity to speak with someone about that, but for the most part, I've never had a negative experience in academia. So,
yeah, a little sneer's a lot better than getting burned at the stake or eaten by lions, for example. A couple of you mentioned sort of wrestling with doubts. What specifically? This is a couple people texted in about this. What were a couple hang-ups for you? What doubts did you wrestle with specifically, and then how did you overcome those? I know you definitely mentioned that, and you talked about faith seeking understanding, and Alex talked about it a little bit too.
A variety of things. I mean, one was the perceived alliance between conservative politics and Christian faith that I grew up with, and that was a difficult thing to grapple with and I think dismantle over time. Hell has been a challenge for me, like the doctrine of hell. And I think I don't know if I've settled on any answer to that exactly, but I think my theological and philosophical education helped a lot just to see the kind of doctrinal diversity that you find even within Orthodox Christianity. So that was one way that philosophy has actually helped me like understand doctrines better. You know, maybe the worst version you heard about hell is not the only way to think about it, you know. So that's a place that philosophy has been extremely helpful to me in preserving faith.
There have been, I mean, as I've come into my faith, there have been lots of doubts along the way. I'll talk about a more recent one. My small group just finished a book on miracles, and it kind of brought this back to me. So my dad passed away about 3 years ago from leukemia. And I remember, he was not a Christian, but I remember during that time praying for a miracle and praying for healing, and it didn't come. And I won't lie that was a moment of doubt for me of like, I know that you can perform miracles, God. Why not this man? I've prayed continuously about this, and why not? And so I wouldn't say it was totally rocked my Christian worldview, but it there were seeds of doubt in that. Just why would God let some things happen? It's kind of tied into the suffering thing. Why would God let suffering happen to some people and not others? I've had doubts along the way. Like I mentioned, I have specific views on certain issues, and some of them don't necessarily line up with a traditional Christian view of things. And so kind of wrestling with, can I have this view? Can it not be counter to my faith, and kind of working through that has helped as well.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to get kind of sciencey here. Is that all right?
Go for it.
So in quantum mechanics, which is our theory, which is our theory for what happens at the microscopic realm. So, you know, particles, individual particles interacting with each other. Everything is governed by probability. So I can't tell you when two particles collide what's going to happen for one of those reactions, but I can provide a probability that some particular thing is going to happen and another probability for some other thing happening. And this, when I first well, first of all, for most physicists, this is earth-shattering. This is the reality. And then when you try to reconcile that with the idea that there is a predestination of all events from our creator, you have to take this macroscopic world where things are determined and this microscopic version where things are probabilistic. And I don't have an answer to this one either.
I've got a paper on that if you want to read it.
All right, check it out.
Somebody actually texted about this very issue. It's funny to you two guys. If physics studies particles that are genuinely fundamental, then what happens with those particles determines physical reality, but my body is part of physical reality. So how can I freely determine what my body does when the fundamental particles determine what my body does? In other words, is there a competition between fundamental physical laws and human freedom, which I was just talking to somebody about this afternoon. It's so fun. Anyway, so do you want to get coffee with somebody? Determinism, free will, how does it work?
Yeah, it's a long answer. I don't know if I want to even broach it. Though there are some presuppositions in the question about...
Nice.
Right. The fundamental physical stuff determining the upper level stuff. So it's not so clear that the upper level stuff, like mind stuff, doesn't also have a causal effect or some determining effect downwards. I'll just leave it there because that's a big issue.
I'm an experimentalist. I live in the world of the things I can measure, and I can't measure this. So I'm going to leave it there.
Okay, so what is something that you wish you could say to students in class but that you don't? And/what advice would you give to students just in general, or if you could, if you had a flux capacitor and you could go back in time to your college self and give yourself advice, what would that be? This is a couple of different questions. Let's break it in two. What's something that you don't say that you wish you could say other than like read the syllabus? It's in the syllabus. Yeah, we do say that a lot.
I guess one thing to say is that you can treat us like regular people because we are, just like you guys are. You know, we have, like we were talking about, we have families, we have experiences that are outside of the campus. You know, just like we assume that you have other activities and things, we do too. And you should feel free to try to engage with us on things that are not just related to the subject that we're teaching. Most of us are happy to talk in office hours and things about this. So you can see us as regular people, and we'll try to do the same.
That's a good one. I would definitely second that. I'm going to be a little meaner on mine. One, I can tell when you're typing on your laptop and not paying attention. I love the smirk when you're like, I'm not saying anything funny. I know that something's going on back there. It's pretty easy to tell. That's just like an FYI. The other one, what am I just thinking? Oh, again, a little bit kind of life advice. So I'm aware that not every lecture that I teach or every class that I teach is scintillating to every student there. But I know, and I even had a student once tell me, oh, well, I'm not paying attention because I just don't find it interesting. And it's like, okay, that's fair. But also, not every job you're going to have is going to be scintillating and, you know, really, you know, in every hour of your day, you're going to be super into it. So the students that I most enjoy are the ones who try to kind of find, no matter if we're talking about budgeting, the budgeting process in the U.S. government, or something more than that, try to kind of stay engaged. I think that's a life lesson, because when you get into your real jobs, the people who rise quickly are the ones who do those menial original tasks with passion and with heart, and then you quickly move on. You can practice that in the class too, because not every lecture is going to be something that you're really super interested in, but it shows to me the people who are like engaged with me and giving me their all, those are the people I know are going to do well outside of the classroom as well. Sorry, that was a lot meaner than yours.
At one of the previous places that I worked at, I encountered a lot of students who you'd give them a D+ and they were like, sweet, I passed. And so the challenge there was to motivate them. It was like, I know that you can do better than a D plus. Here it's like the reverse. And I always want to tell students, just take it easy. Like, it's okay to get a B. You're not going to get into Yale Law School. You're going to get into NYU. That's totally fine. Your life is going to go well. So just take down the temperature gauge, you know, a little bit here. You know, it's just, there's not that much at stake for each individual paper, for each individual class. So learn and have fun. I mean, that's the most important thing, is you learn how to learn. You learn how to think.
So flux capacitor. Time machine. That's a reference to an 80s movie called Back to the Future, in which a young man travels through time by means of a flux capacitor. And what is a flux capacitor, Justin? I've always wanted
to know. If I knew, I wouldn't be here.
Ouch. Kind of hurt my feelings a little bit. So if you could go back in time and give yourself advice in college.
I think it would follow along with the last comment that each incremental step along the way is not that important, and we recognize that just like we're real people, you're regular people too, and you're going to have bad days. So if you have an exam that doesn't go well, we don't think less of you because of that. You're not less of a person because you did worse on this exam than you might have liked to, but you can recover from that and try to do better on the next one. So I think taking those things with a grain of salt, and also not feeling like you have to come and apologize for that, because it happens, and following the same track. Sometimes I'm going to have a bomb lecture, and it's just not going to be good. And I appreciate if you will also be graceful in that side of things.
Mine follows along your original comment on getting to know your professors. So I didn't nearly do enough of this. I felt like I had to have a question to go into office hours with something that I was struggling about. But now that I'm on this side of the classroom, the table, it's one of the things I love the most about my job, is getting to know my students. And so I love it when people visit me in office hours, and I tell my students, you can come without a question, you can come just to chat. And I regret for sure not doing even kind of a fraction of that when I was in college.
I would have told myself not to worry so much. I'm just kind of an anxious person in general, and so I remember that kind of looming large. And I wish I had discovered philosophy earlier. I was like, pay attention.
Take
to that
intro
class.
Freshman yeah. year, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Your advice.
Yeah. But yeah, the overcoming bad grades was actually an issue for me. I got the D plus in calculus. I'm telling you now. I was not happy about it like my other students, but. But yeah, I got a D plus in Calc 1, and it was devastating at the time, and it was difficult to like come back. But it was okay in the long run.
Great. Well, thank you guys so much for being here. I want to read something here. So one of the reasons we're doing this is, one of the goals of RUF is that we would begin to think more thoroughly and more richly about your academic endeavors. If you're a believer, that you would think more Christianly about the actual schoolwork that you do. And if you're not a believer, that you would begin to understand that this is something that Christianity sort of has on the table for you. So I'm going to read a passage that was written by a former professor of mine. His name's Jay Green. It's in a little booklet called Faithful Learning, an Invitation to Academic Study. It's a little long, but it's really good, and I think it kind of encapsulates kind of what we're shooting for here. So he's talking about the world and the creation that God has made, and the effects of sin on that. And then he says this. He says, when we think of creation, we're probably most apt to picture snow-covered mountains, flowering dogwood trees, herds of buffalo, or a majestic sunset. We are less likely to include within our vision of creation human endeavors like music theory, mechanical engineering, experimental psychology, or graphic design. Or human artifacts like a geometric proof, a research paper on Chaucer, a legal brief, or a demographic table correlating unemployment figures with the ethnic makeup of a mid-sized American city. But the modern academic disciplines are, in fact, a part of God's good order. All are examples of humans cultivating nature's raw materials and the human imagination as collective responses to God's general command to care for the earth. The academic disciplines are both extensions of creation and one of the most consequential ways that we exercise our dominion over that which God has made. As such, they are legitimate spheres of good human work, even when they are controlled by us sinners, even when their most masterful practitioners are unbelievers, which they typically are, and even when they are used for nefarious purposes. Are they affected by sin? Indeed. Is their necessity or legitimacy diminished in any way because of it? I don't think so, and then this is the sweet spot. Okay. As a part of creation, these fields of academic inquiry are precious and astonishing gifts from God. But I wonder how many of us have ever looked at an accounting textbook and been overcome with a profound sense of gratitude. How often have we gazed at the trigonometric functions on our calculators, sine, cosine, or tangent, and fallen on our faces praising God for his magnanimous kindness in providing these rich tools of mathematical insight? Do we ever feel weak in the knees? Whoa. With joyful thanksgiving when practicing scales, conjugating verbs, reading 19th century primary documents, vetting footnotes using the Chicago Manual of Style, or cleaning brushes after a long night of painting. Rarely, I would guess, perhaps we have been moved at one point or another to thank God for the knowledge and skills of a surgeon who removed a cancerous tumor from a parent, or the keen and knowing eye of an airplane pilot who landed the plane in a terrible storm, or the engineer who designed our car's anti-lock brake system when we've been forced to stop short. It is easy to take the world of learning for granted, especially living as we do in an affluent, technologically advanced society. But then he goes on to say, these wondrous insights and skills were each honed within institutions of human exploration and innovation known as the university. They are good gifts from a good and gracious God. We need to move these fields of study conceptually back within the bounds of creational goodness where they belong and allow ourselves to be amazed and thrilled by the worlds of joyful discovery that they open up to us when we enter into them with this kind of expectation. This sense of wonder can't help but overflow into gratitude to God. So I love that quote. I love that passage. Because so much of what we're doing here on campus is sort of learning to think and honing our minds and getting our hands dirty with our thoughts and with the world around us, and to go out, and maybe that stress culture that's been alluded to already will be reduced a little bit less if we had a little bit more wonder and a little bit more joy and a little bit more curiosity and freedom to just explore and play and work in this world that God's given us. And that's what you guys are doing every day in your fields, and that you're training and equipping these guys to do. And so we're so grateful for you, and so grateful that you would be here with us tonight. So let's give it up for our people, and we got a couple quick announcements. So.